From Pacifico Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Out of bed, let's go! Wake up, come on, let's go!
Welcome to the Louisiana State Penitentiary in Angola. My name is Wilbur Grito, and this has been my home for the past 30 years.
Today, we'll look at the case of prison reporter Will Burrito. An appeals court has thrown out his murder conviction. We'll speak with the head of his defense committee, as well as the DA who wants him tried again and wants him to get the death penalty. Also, the documentary on Angola prison, Tossing Away the Keys. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Civil rights groups opposing President-elect Bush's choice for Attorney General John Ashcroft are demanding that Democratic senators vote against the nomination. The groups will join with organized labor to confront Democrats at public events to win commitments of a no vote. Ashcroft has drawn opposition for his anti-abortion views and for leading a successful drive to defeat the nomination of a black Missouri Supreme Court judge, Ronnie White, to the federal bench. The Reverend Jesse Jackson said yesterday the campaign also will target New Jersey Governor Christine Todd Whitman, Bush's nominee to head the Environmental Protection Agency. Whitman has drawn the ire of blacks because of racial profiling by the New Jersey State Police and because the governor personally frisked a black youth for a photo op. President-elect Bush is readying an education package that would aggressively test students and cut federal funds for schools that failed to measure up. Aides say that despite significant opposition in Congress, he will not abandon a school voucher plan. As he puts the finishing touches on his cabinet this week, Bush also is weighing how to present his education proposals to Congress. He said that lawmakers are certain to see his proposals just after he takes office on January 20th. After scores of complaints and lawsuits concerning the physical and mental abuse of immigrants detained in county jails and other detention centers, the Immigration and Naturalization Service has issued national standards for the treatment of its detainees. The new standards, covering everything from visiting policies to grievance procedures, will be phased in this month at all detention centers administered by the Immigration Service. They'll be phased in over the next 2 years at state and local jails that house Immigration Service detainees. But critics say the agency has fallen far short of that goal, especially in county jails in states like Louisiana, Texas, New Jersey, and Florida, where detainees and their lawyers say prisoners are beaten, solitary confinement is imposed for trivial offenses, and water and food are often inadequate. And advocates for immigrants say conditions may not improve even after the standards are in place because they don't have the weight of law and could prove impossible to enforce. Just 2 months ago, Salvadorans, Guatemalans, and other refugees from Central America were ecstatic. President Clinton had threatened to veto a final budget deal unless more than 1 million immigrants, including them, were allowed a chance at becoming legal residents. But in the wake of elections that favored Republicans and facing fierce GOP opposition to broader proposals, Clinton has dropped his threat and agreed to an immigration package last month that helps just over half as many people. In the end, about 400,000 immigrants from Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, plus 50,000 or so from Haiti and Liberia, find themselves with little reasonable chance at becoming legal U.S. residents, let alone citizens. And many, including tens of thousands in the Washington area, are likely to face new threats of deportation after more than a decade of living in the United States. Palestinian President Yasser Arafat left the Gaza Strip last night for surprise talks with President Clinton on the U.S. peace proposal that's drawing strong Palestinian reservations. In the proposal, the Palestinians would get a state in 95% of the West Bank and all of Gaza and partial control over a contested holy site in East Jerusalem. In exchange, the Palestinians would drop their demand for a right of return for Palestinian refugees who were driven out of Israel when it was founded in 1948. Arafat agreed last night to meet with Clinton in order to hear clarifications on the proposal. Meanwhile, new violence flared in the Gaza Strip today as Israeli soldiers killed a Palestinian farmer and wounded seven in two separate shootings, and two Israeli soldiers were injured by roadside bombs. Israeli troops have tightened their blockade of Palestinian towns and closed three main roadways in Gaza, effectively cutting the Strip in half. In other Middle East news, Saudi Arabia has signed a $2 billion arms deal with the United States, according to a U.S. diplomat. The deal includes a three-year contract worth $1.6 billion to maintain the kingdom's F-16 jet fighters and will employ 1,000 people, including 10 representing the American government. The deal also involves a project to modernize the Saudi National Guard. Saudi Arabia is the United States' main ally in the Gulf region and is host to about 5,000 U.S. troops. Puerto Rico's new anti-statehood governor said yesterday she will hold true to pledges to oust the U.S. Navy from a bombing range and resolve the island's conflicted relationship with Washington. Sheila Calderon is opposed to U.S. statehood, which was championed by the outgoing governor. Her victory in November and her popular Democratic Party's success in winning the local legislature were seen as a collective no to making Puerto Rico the 51st state. And you're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Today we're going to take a look at a major decision that President Clinton has made. This is a decision that involves the International Criminal Court. In a down-to-the-wire decision praised by human rights advocates, the United States signed a treaty to create the world's first permanent war crimes court, despite fears that Americans could be unfairly targeted. President Clinton authorized the signature on New Year's Eve, the last day possible, to, quote, reaffirm our strong support for international accountability and for bringing to justice perpetrators of genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity. However, reflecting concerns in the Pentagon and among congressional Republicans, Clinton said his successor should not ask the Senate to ratify the treaty until the United States is satisfied that its personnel abroad would not be taken to court in frivolous or politically motivated prosecutions. Clinton's reservations made his action largely symbolic, but it was also pragmatic. It will allow the United States to remain actively involved in negotiations to create the court, which is expected to come into existence in about 2 years. The tribunal would be the first permanent institution created specifically to try people charged with war crimes, genocide, and crimes against humanity. It would step in when governments are unwilling or unable to prosecute their own citizens for the gravest atrocities. However, any ratification attempt would likely face fierce opposition from conservatives led by Senator Jesse Helms, the chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, who said Sunday that Clinton's decision will not stand. Helms has pledged to give top priority during the congressional session starting next week to passage of a bill that would bar U.S. cooperation with any such international tribunal. We're joined on the phone right now by Reed Brody, who is Advocacy Director of Human Rights Watch. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
Well, can you tell us about President Clinton's decision to sign the International War Crimes Tribunal Treaty?
It was a very important symbolic decision. As you said, it doesn't bind the United States to ratify the treaty, and obviously that's going to be a very difficult uphill fight with the Republican Senate, and I don't think that George W. Bush is going to be pushing for that. But it does commit the U.S. to act positively towards this emerging tribunal. This tribunal, as you said, is going to be the first permanent court with the ability to bring to justice the perpetrators of the world's worst crimes. The United States has been fighting for years, really for an exemption for its own soldiers and policymakers, an exemption that, understandably, the rest of the world does not find acceptable. The United States continues to push for that exemption, but today's or this weekend's decision by President Clinton is a very important boost to that court.
When the president says that they're concerned about soldiers being brought up on frivolous charges, can you talk about who really could be held accountable if an international war crimes tribunal does go forward?
I think it's a very important question. The court statute provides numerous guarantees against frivolous prosecutions. A prosecutor would have to convince two sets of judges that the charges are well brought. These judges are going to be elected by majority of the states who are members of the court. These are going to be the leading international jurists in the world. As you also mentioned, the court will only kick in when national systems are either unwilling or unable to prosecute. So I don't think the real worry here is about frivolous prosecutions. And I also don't think the real worry is about servicemen. I think the real worry here and what the Pentagon objects to is that the Pentagon wants the ability to wage war without a bunch of judges looking over its shoulder. It wants to take decisions which it believes are in the United States national interest, irrespective of whether those decisions violate the rules of war and the Geneva Conventions.
We see the power of the U.S. signing on to this because soon after Clinton did, Israel did at the right before the New Year's deadline for this.
Well, Israel and the United States were two of the seven countries that voted against this treaty when it was established 2 years ago by in a UN conference in Rome. The vote was 120 in favor and seven against. And the United States and Israel were joined by China, Iraq, Libya, Qatar, Oman, countries that one doesn't usually associate with the promotion and protection of human rights. And obviously, Israel and the United States have a strategic alliance and Israel was not going to sign the treaty until the U.S. signed it, and then Israel came in the last hour and signed the treaty.
Now, I mentioned that Senate Foreign Relations Committee Chair Jesse Helms said the decision will not stand, that he will make it one of his highest priorities to fight this treaty being passed by the Senate. Also, the incoming or the nominee for Secretary of Defense, Rumsfeld, is one of those who has fought hard against this. What will that mean?
Interestingly, President-elect Bush has not taken a position on the treaty. As you mentioned, Donald Rumsfeld has. A lot of Republicans have joined the chorus against the treaty, and the Pentagon obviously is going to have a great deal of influence in the new administration. And the Pentagon has been the source of opposition to the International Criminal Court for the reasons we've talked about. Having signed the treaty, it's an accepted principle of international law that by signing a treaty, a government is obliged, even if it doesn't ratify, not to violate the spirit of the treaty unless it signals a clear intention not to ratify. Now, that means that unless President-elect Bush gets up and says, "We are not going to ratify this treaty, I disavow the signature," the United States really is obliged under international law not to try to undermine the treaty. And the kind of legislation that Jesse Helms is proposing, which would bar any U.S. Assistance to the court, which would require that, which would even withdraw U.S. assistance from non-NATO countries that sign the court's treaty, could be seen as undermining the spirit of the treaty.
There is other news around the issue of war crimes and crimes against humanity, and that is that last week, on December 26th, Chile's top court effectively left the fate of former dictator Augusto Pinochet in the hands of doctors rather than judges. It vacated the indictments against him that had just been handed down to in Chile. Can you explain what's happened?
A few weeks ago, a Chilean judge indicted General Pinochet for murders and disappearances committed in 1973. Pinochet's lawyers went to court saying that he had the right to be interrogated before he was indicted. That case went up to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court said Pinochet is right. He has to be interrogated first, but go ahead and interrogate him. But first, you've got to give him medical. Under Chilean law, anyone over 70 must be given medical and physical tests to see if they're able to stand trial. So where we stand now is that Pinochet is going to have medical and in particular mental tests, and then he will be presumably interrogated by the judge. And depending on the results of the medical test, he probably will be indicted.
Now, let's look at the Pinochet case, if there was an international war crimes tribunal. It was Britain that first indicted Pinochet, or rather, it was Britain that first answered a call from Spain to have an extradited there where he would be tried for crimes against humanity. If there was an international criminal court in place, what would have happened?
It depends on whether Chile had ratified the treaty or not. Because of concessions made to the United States, the International Criminal Court has limited jurisdiction only where the country on whose territory the crimes occurred or the country of the defendant's nationality accepts jurisdiction. Does the court have jurisdiction? So if Chile, of course, in the case of Pinochet, he committed crimes in a lot of countries, including in Washington and Buenos Aires. But assuming that a Chilean commits crimes against humanity in Chile, the question is whether or not Chile has ratified the treaty. If Chile ratifies the treaty or otherwise accepts the jurisdiction of the court, and Chile does not prosecute, then the International Criminal Court would kick in. The International Criminal Court is really a backstop for the worst cases that are not being tried in national jurisdictions.
And it will reside in?
The Hague in the Netherlands.
As we move into this next millennium, and we're here, do you think that the issue of human rights is one that will be on the forefront, that we've made progress, or do you think with superpower like the United States very much calling the shots that, we're not moving ahead?
Difficult question. I think the idea of human rights has spread. I think people use from unionists in the Philippines to women's organizations in Bolivia, the idea of human rights, the language of human rights has taken hold. And that makes it more difficult for governments, I think, to trample on people's rights. Obviously, governments, if they're not held to account by people, are going to violate human rights when it's in their interest to do so.
Reed Brody, I want to thank you for being with us. Reed Brody is Advocacy Director of Human Rights Watch. The website is www.hrw.org. Thanks for being with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going to hear about the remarkable story of the lifers at the Angola prison in Louisiana. And we're going to hear, in particular, the man who narrates this documentary, Wilbert Rito. Wilbert Rito has recently had his murder conviction overturned by a U.S. Court of Appeals. The response, the local DA is asking for him to be tried again and wants to impose the death penalty against him. He's been in prison for almost 40 years. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! After the documentary, we'll talk to the district attorney as well as a man who served in prison with him for 30 years. Stay with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit recently overturned the murder conviction of author and editor Wilbert Rito, who's been in prison in Angola, Louisiana, for more than 39 years. Rito has served for 25 years as the editor of the award-winning prison publication, The Angolite. He had been on death row until 1972, when the Supreme Court overturned all death sentences. Rito's conviction was reversed recently because of racial discrimination in the selection of the grand jury, which indicted him. Now, Louisiana plans to appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court, and even if the state loses, Rito could be retried. We're going to go to Louisiana and speak with the head of his defense committee. Wilbert Rito can't join us from the prison. And also speak with the district attorney, who says that he not only wants to retry the case, but he wants Wilbert Rito now, after 39 years, to face the death penalty again. But before we go there, we're going to hear a documentary called Tossing Away the Keys that was produced by David Isay with Ron Wickberg and Wilbert Rito himself. It was recorded at the Angola prison, and it was premiered 10 years ago. It's narrated by Wilbert Rito himself and tells the story of the men serving life sentences without the possibility of parole at the nation's largest prison. This is Tossing Away the Keys.
Wake up call, let's go. Get up. Out of bed, let's go. Wake up, come on, let's go.
Welcome to the Louisiana State Penitentiary at Angola. My name is Wilbert Rito, and this has been my home for the past 30 years. I'm serving a life sentence here for a murder I committed during a bank robbery in 1961. I'm also a journalist. For the past 15 years, I've edited the prison magazine, The Angolite. While Alcatraz, Attica, Sing Sing, and San Quentin are all part of the American vocabulary, you may well never have heard of Angola. But hidden at the end of a long road in the most remote part of Louisiana, this prison has a history unlike any other. In the 1950s, it was officially labeled the worst prison in the country. In the 1970s, daily inmate murders branded it the bloodiest. Angola doesn't look like your typical maximum security prison. It's a sprawling prison plantation stretching for miles in all directions, with fields, creeks, lakes, and woods. The prison is surrounded on three sides by the Mississippi River, on the fourth by rattlesnake-infested hills. Most of us live within the huge main prison complex, enclosed by 14-foot-high fences, reinforced with endless loops of razor wire, guard towers, and an army of security personnel. Behind these fences, there's a massive, unprecedented experiment taking place. The state is locking up large numbers of men and throwing away the keys so that they age and eventually die behind bars. Traditionally, most prisoners serving life sentences have had the opportunity to go free after about 10 years. But in the early 1970s, Louisiana politicians came upon what was then a novel idea. They decided to make life sentences in Louisiana mean precisely that. They did away with the possibility of parole. Today, there are more than 2,500 men serving their so-called natural life sentence here at Angola. A number have now been here for some 30 years. Of those who've survived, most are in their 50s or 60s or 70s, the first generation of lifers to reach their twilight behind bars.
Come over here, I want to introduce you to the beautiful rose bush on the whole yard. This is one here, is my favorite. I named it after my wife, Ernestine. It's a beautiful pink rose. And some way or another, I keep it trimmed and uniformed up until I call it my beauty. I know it sounds funny, but these are my company keepers. I enjoy these bushes. See, if it wasn't for these bushes, I wouldn't have nothing to do. So these bushes have come to be close, close, very close to me.
My name is Maurice Bickham. My number is 75251, and I'm 72 years old. I've been in prison since 1958. My crime is murder of two white deputies in a small town called Mandeville. They was dragons of the Ku Klux Klan, and I was a black man living in a white neighborhood. And they came to my house to kill me. They shot me with my hands up, and I fell and loaded my gun, and I shot him. So here I am, 31 years later, and I'm still locked up. I remember when my first gray hair came in my head. I was up here. I was in jail in 1960. It came right up in front where I could see it good. By 1961, I had one in my mustache. By 63, I had gray hairs all over my head. I've had three heart attacks since I've been here. The big one was in 1977 when the parting board turned me down. I lost all my teeth since I've been here. My eyesight went bad. I have high blood pressure, poor blood circulation. Yeah, I watched myself pass away, die little by little every day.
My name is Henry L. Patterson. My prison number is 54915. I've been in Angola for 30 years. I'm serving a life sentence for a murder I committed in a barroom fight. You know you're going to age. Then one day, a young guy walk up to you. Hey, Pop. And you get offended at first, you know. What you mean, Pop? You know my name, Pop. Don't call me no Pop, man. But then you go lay back a little bit, and you sit down, and you analyze, and you say, well, I am Pop now. I'm old, I'm gray, and I'm no longer Patterson. I'm Pop Patterson.
I'm Monroe Green. I'm 57 years old. My number is 62694. I've been at Angola for 24 years and 6 months. Serving a life sentence for rape. In the morning, all the younger men will crowd the mirrors. None of us older men will even use a mirror to shave in. It took me a while to figure it out, but we don't like to see ourselves growing older each day.
Since I've been locked up, I lost all my family mostly. I can see losing my mother and father, but all my sisters and brothers, all my aunts and uncles. God bless me now. The judge is dead, the DA is dead, the lawyer's dead. Everybody's passed on but me. And when I look at it, I say, Lord, why I'm still here? It makes you wonder.
Time is now. Time is now. Serve the Lord.
To serve the Lord.
Time is right now.
Time is now.
To serve the Lord.
To serve the Lord.
Done got so late.
It's late in the evening.
And the sun is going down.
Sun is going.
Most long-termers adapt to prison life by immersing themselves completely in some sort of activity. It's our way of escaping the reality of our situation. Some lose themselves in religion or sports or music. Others in violence and drugs. I lost myself in writing. I educated myself on death row, where I lived from the age of 19 until I was 31. Although religious literature was all we were allowed to read in a death row cell, some guards managed to smuggle books to me. I read everything I could get my hands on and began to write. In 1972, when the Supreme Court overturned the death penalty, I left death row and 3 years later became editor of the prison magazine, The Angleite. Our cramped office is down the hall from the main prison control center near cell blocks C and D. Here, six of us work at old office furniture to turn out the bi-monthly magazine. At the desk next to mine sits associate editor Ron Wickberg, who's serving a life sentence for murder committed during an armed robbery. It was Ron's in-depth study of long-termers which brought national attention to the very real possibility that Angola will soon become the nation's largest old folks' home.
The old-timers here at Angola are in a state of semi-retirement. Instead of working in the fields like they had for many, many years, they've turned in their hoes, their shovels, for canes, wheelchairs, crutches. They wear glasses, they wear false teeth. The prison management gives them menial assignments, cleaning doorknobs, washing windows, sweeping floors. They shuffle from place to place. They're no longer productive. And non-productive prisoners are kind of pushed to the side. This is a place of hard labor. This is a place where prisoners are required to work. Prisoners who can't work are kind of put to the side, just allowed to exist.
There are now hundreds of elderly prisoners existing here at Angola. Most are housed with the general prison population, some confined to their beds, many subject to theft and harassment from younger inmates. Those just too old or sick live on the overcrowded wards of the prison hospital, stretching Angola's health care budget far past its limits. These long-termers have now spent more time in prison than the country's most infamous criminals and gangsters. Many have, in their own right, committed very, very serious offenses. But no matter the crime, no matter whether or not they've changed over the decades here at Angola, there's no way out for them.
The long-termers were put in prison 20 and 30 years ago. They have been forgotten about in prison. And that is where the problem begins. There is no mechanism to recognize when a person becomes rehabilitated. And at that point, some effort should be made to move them out of the system. It is the lack of this mechanism which has allowed the lifers population to increase 300% in just 10 years here in Louisiana. And this problem is not just in Louisiana, it's nationwide.
If y'all wouldn't mind rising, please, and remove the headgear. Please repeat after me. We members of the Lifers Association,
members of the Lifers Association,
Louisiana State Penitentiary,
Louisiana State Penitentiary,
in Angola, Louisiana,
Angola, Louisiana,
join together
for
the improvement,
for the improvement
of ourselves,
in
society.
And society.
We have love in our hearts,
we have love in our hearts,
for all men. Hope in our spirit, that our wrongs
will be overshadowed
by our rights.
The Lifers Association meets on the last Tuesday of every month here in the visiting room. Support groups like this one are filled to capacity with many inmates on their waiting list. Newly incarcerated lifers need only look to the old faces and pained eyes of the long-termers to understand the nightmare which lies in store for them.
No matter how dark the night,
we believe
the coming of the day.
Thank
you, gentlemen.
My name is Don Buffett, and people call me Frog. My number, 57391. I've been in Angola for the past 28 years, serving a life sentence for the rape of a white woman. The best way I can describe Angola for a long time is that it's something out of science fiction.
My name is Joe White. My number is 56310. I've been incarcerated for murder here in Angola since 1961. I've been here so long, it's difficult to imagine how it feels to be free. I don't think people can conceive what it what it means to spend all your life in prison.
I find technology amazing. You know, I find with the, I don't know for sure, but they say they got super highways now, okay? Where you bypass the cities and all, so you don't have to go slow down and just straight through. And I never rode on no super highway, you know that, I wouldn't even know how to get on one. I wouldn't even know what to do if I get on one. They say you got lanes that you get in, you say fast, slow. You know what I'm talking about? And all these things, see, you say, boy, this is amazing.
If he was to be buried alive, that's what it would be like. Except for the television, we would know that there's a world out there. Except for the radios, we wouldn't know. We actually come here. And when we come here, everything stops. This is a graveyard. A graveyard of time.
I feel like my life has been frozen in time. You know what I mean? Like the Crosby Show. I look at those kind of shows and I wonder sometimes, is it fiction? Is it really real? You know, because I can only relate to that which I came here out of in 61. When I came here in 1961, the restaurants were segregated. When I caught a bus, I caught the back end of the bus. I had to go to the back. I couldn't sit in the front. You look at the changes, you know, in that time, the period you stop, and they say, well, they're doing this today, they're doing that. You wonder, is it real? You know, that's for real, man?
The living dead is an accurate description of it. Because the things that it takes to live, to feel life, you're not in contact with that. We fantasize. That's all we have left, is our fantasies and our dreams. And this is what a lot of people rely on to make it.
I often picture my son in my mind's eye. The last time I saw him, he was 10 years old. And now he's 35. I often imagine the scene of when James and I face each other the first time. What will I do? Will we move toward each other? Will I be able to hug him? What response will I get from that hug? Will it be a loving hug? This picture runs over and over in my mind. It's like a dream that occurs over and over and over.
It's as if you don't exist. It's like you and the spirit and everything around you is alive, and you can't touch, you can't reach, you can't do anything but just look. We can't touch people's lives. We can't touch their lives. That's what tears us up. Can't touch your lives.
Got a real life.
Recently, some disturbing things have begun to happen here, even by Angola's standards. It started a year ago with a long-term inmate named Francis Clifton. After serving 27 years of a life sentence for murder at Angola, Clifton had a most comfortable prison job. He was living outside the razor wire fences of the main prison complex, in a house here at the pens where he tended Angola's bloodhounds and attack dogs. At 52, he could have served the rest of his sentence free of chains and guards. But last April, Clifton ran. For 5 days, he hid in the hills, evading the bloodhounds which he, better than anyone, knew would eventually catch up with him. On the fifth day, exhausted, Clifton walked out of the hills, flagged down a car, and turned himself in.
When you finally realize you're going to die here, it just starts working on your mind. That's a terrible thing. Just know you're going to stay in here until you die.
Clifton has spent the year since his capture in solitary confinement.
In spite of all the other fears and problems out there and worries on my mind, and the guards running all over the place with guns chasing me and knowing I could be shot at any time, I still was able to enjoy that little bit of freedom after 28 years.
A few weeks later, it happened again. Long-term inmate Donald Fink was being marched into the fields for a day's work. Suddenly, he turned and began to walk away. "I'm going home," he said. And as he started to run, the guards lifted their guns, aimed, and fired. Things got worse from there. Angola erupted in an unprecedented epidemic of attempted escapes, suicides, and killings. Many involved old-timers, traditionally the most stable inmates at the prison. By mid-summer 1989, a federal judge was forced to declare a state of emergency here. That order is still in effect today, and the desperate acts continue. Hopelessness is creeping through the tiers and cell blocks of Angola.
To me, I think life without the possibility of pardon or parole, if you know you have no hope for pardon or parole, would be worse than the death sentence, if you know you're going to die at Angola.
Hilton Butler was warden here until a state of emergency was declared last August. Butler had worked at Angola for 40 years, but when things started getting out of hand, he was fired.
I'm no softy. I gave the signal for the switch to be pulled on the electric chair 11 times while I was warden. But I feel what's going on at Angola now is wrong. You've got to give an inmate hope. When he gives up hope, he's lost everything.
In today's political climate, the last hope for lifers, a pardon from the governor, has all but disappeared. A year ago, Louisiana's Governor Buddy Roma let Christmas pass without granting a single clemency. It was the first time that this had happened in the state's history. Here, prisoners finally began to comprehend the grim reality of natural life sentences. For many, particularly the older men, the fragile illusion of eventual freedom crumbled.
Since I was convicted of the rape 28 years ago, I've had a recommendation from the pardon board 6 times to go. Even the victim have asked for my release, but yet the governor still refused to let me go. So it seemed like, you know, that we're going to die here.
Point Lookout, see, we sometimes call it Boot Hill. It's a place here in Angola where they buried the dead. Old-timers think about it a right good deal, but they don't talk about it much because they're afraid that they might get buried out there. See, you buried out there, you really forgotten. Because nobody comes here to see you. Nobody even passes by Boot Hill.
When you die at Angola, you don't die as Henry Patterson lies. Here you die as 549 number 5 is in the ground up there. I don't want to die no more. I don't want to die insignificant no more. Nobody. What is that, a prison number?
You've been listening to Tossing Away the Keys, produced by Dave Isay, Ron Wickberg, and Will Burrito. Will Burrito's case, murder conviction, was just overturned by the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit. That documentary done in 1990. He has now served 39 years in prison. When we return from our break, we will go down to Louisiana, where we'll speak with the district attorney who has vowed to retry his case, as well as the head of his defense committee, and a man who served 30 years at Angola, the largest prison in the United States, with Will Burrito. You're listening to Pacific Radio's Democracy Now! Back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Well, just 2 weeks ago, the Fifth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals threw out a murder conviction of Wilbert Rito's, the 39-year-old murder conviction of the award-winning prison journalist, was thrown out by a federal appeals court that ordered him freed if the state doesn't retry him in a reasonable amount of time. The Fifth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals said Rito's conviction for the 1961 fatal shooting and stabbing of a bank teller must be overturned because Calcasieu Parish officials discriminated against black people in selecting the grand jury that indicted him. A three-judge panel unanimously said such action violated the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. Rito, who is 58 years old, is African-American. Only one person on the 20-member grand jury was black. The ruling sends the case back to a U.S. district judge named Frank Palazzola of Baton Rouge with an order to free Rito unless the state decides to try him a fourth time. In a one-paragraph statement, the Calcasieu Parish District Attorney, Rick Bryant, said he'll appeal the decision to the U.S. Supreme Court. After initially being turned down for a position on the Angolite newspaper, which had an all-white staff, Wilbert Rito started a publication called The Lifer and wrote a column for black newspapers. In 76, he was named editor of the Angolite and used the publication to examine such topics as inmate suicide, rape, riots, executions, and prisoner rights. The magazine has been showered with honors, including the Robert F. Kennedy Journalism Award, the American Bar Association Civil Gavel Award, the George Polk Award for Special Interest Reporting. Wilbert Rito was the co-director of The Farm, a 1998 documentary about Louisiana State Penitentiary that was nominated for an Academy Award. We're going to turn now to the district attorney who has vowed to retry this case from Calcasieu Parish, Rick Bryant. Also, the head of the Wilbert Rito Defense Committee joins us on the telephone from Louisiana as well, Linda LaBranche. Rick Bryant, can you give us your response to the federal appeals court decision to overturn the conviction of Wilbert Rito?
Well, we were disappointed in that decision. Obviously, we had won most of the criminal appeals that have been filed. Our biggest concern was the overturning of the conviction based on the selection of the grand jury, which is in reality only an accusatory body. It has no real power. It just determines if there's enough evidence to hold a matter over for trial. And we had two living victim witnesses, two or three confessions, and Mr. Rito was caught in the stolen vehicle with the stolen money and the gun and the knife and et cetera. So it seems unusual that the three juries which convicted Mr. Rito, which were all white and gave him the death penalty, were never overturned. But the basis for this overturning of the decision was the selection of the grand jury, which obviously we know back in the 60s and the 50s, the procedures they used then certainly aren't the procedures we use now. But obviously we were disappointed in that decision.
Linda LaBranche, your response as co-ordinator of the Rito Project.
Well, obviously, we were very happy with that decision. And in fact, it's even though the grand jury is just, as Mr. Bryant says, an accusatory body, it is the point from which everything flows. All the trial juries and everything else flow from it. The United States Supreme Court has held for over a century that there can't be discrimination in the choosing of the grand jury. So we were very happy with the decision. We feel that Mr. Rito should have been out of prison years ago if he had been treated fairly the way other prisoners have been treated and released on the basis of rehabilitation. So we hope that this is the first step in the process of seeing his freedom. If we have to go back to trial, his lawyers are perfectly willing to do that. We hope it won't be necessary, but if that's what they want, that's what will happen.
Well, let me ask you, Mr. Bryant, you weren't the original prosecutor. Many of the judges who heard Wilbert Rito's case are dead, as are many of the witnesses. The murder weapons and 1961 grand jury records can't be found. Do you think you could win another conviction?
We'll convict him. There's no doubt. He'll be convicted if we retry the case.
Is it true that you've asked for the death penalty? You say
no,
that you
No, that's
would...
not true. There is some law that indicates that in a retrial, possibly you could seek the death penalty. It's very doubtful we would seek that in this case. I think that's not appropriate. I don't even think the victims are concerned with that. They're simply concerned that Mr. Rito remain in prison. So I have no doubt that any retrial, which I think is an unnecessary expense, it's unnecessary grieving on the families to go through this process again, to go through this whole charade, I would call it again, to retry Mr. Rito. I feel very strongly we'll convict him. We're already working on that process. We have ample evidence to convict him of the same crime. He's admitted to it about 300 times since he's been in prison, so I don't think there's any problem in convicting Mr. Rito. The problem is having to go through that process again that brings up old wounds on both sides.
Now, apparently the Pardon Board has made recommendations for Wilbert Rito's release since 1984, but a succession of governors have turned him down. We're joined on the line also by Joe White. We just heard him in the documentary. At the time he was in prison, he served for 30 years with Wilbert Rito. Your response to the case, Joe White?
Well, frankly speaking, I think Wilbert should be given the chance to go free. I think he's earned that right. On top of that, you have the fact that Wilbert spent nearly 40 years of his life dealing with this particular matter. He spent 10 of those 39 years or so on death row. And a couple of convictions were overturned. And I think when the 1972 Supreme Court ruling overturned his case, I think for the third time, basically it took him off of death row and put him into the population. Prior to that time, inmates were getting out of the prison based on 10 years and 6 months practice. I was a candidate for that. And that same year when the Supreme Court overturned the death penalty, Wilbert was let off of death row. The legislature hurriedly went into session, a special session, and they changed the law in midstream. They just said, we're going to stop this practice. And all this was based on the fact that Wilbert Rito would have a chance to get out of prison under the 10 years and 6 months law. So they changed that law, took that away from us, and took hope away from me and others. And as a result of that, the men in prison found themselves not having anything to look forward to from that point on.
Joe White, did Wilbert Rito admit the crime to you? Did he say he committed the murder?
No. For the most part, Wilbert never talked about the crime.
But he has admitted it.
Yes, he has admitted it publicly, like Mr. Bryan said. But in the prison, he carried himself in an upstanding way. He never got in trouble in the prison. He never broke the rules in the prison. And we told my man spent all that time in prison. And, you know, considering the fact that he had committed such a horrific crime, there was no indication of that type of behavior in his character during all the time that I spent with him.
Do you think he's the same man he was 40
no,
years ago?
No, if they killed Will, but now they would be killed in a better person. Wilbert that committed this crime, for all purposes, is dead. I don't think he exists anymore. There's nothing left of that person.
Linda LaBranch, coordinator of the Rito Project.
Right. I would like to say something in response to what Joe is
If you could speak as loud as you can, we have a very bad connection with
oh,
you.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I would like to say something, again, in response to something that both Joe and Mr. Bryant said. Wilbert has always accepted responsibility for his part in what happened back in 1961. However, Wilbert has not talked about the crime. He has never taken the stand in defense of himself, and the only statements that he's ever made about the crime do not agree with the version of the crime that the district attorney's office has been putting out for 30 years. So while he's always admitted his taken responsibility for what he did. He has never admitted to the kind of graphic, horrific crime that has been described for 30 years.
Rick Bryan, is there any chance of a settlement here after Wilbert Rito has, you know, been in prison for 40 years, well known around the country for his prison writings and for setting up this newspaper for prisoners to express themselves at Angola?
Well, let me explain something to you. I'm not a pardon board. There have been, I believe, three pardon boards recommended commutation of his sentence over our objections, over the judge's objections, over the family's objections, over law enforcement's objections. The governors could have signed those pardons, including Governor Edwin Edwards, who is a strong supporter, well-known within the black community in the state of Louisiana. He refused to sign it on two occasions. Two other governors refused to sign it. We have never, and I've been here 21 years, ever joined in for the release of anyone convicted of first or second degree murder. We have always objected. Those persons who have been released over our objections and over that of the family. Their problem as to whether he should be released or not probably should be argued with the governors who don't sign it or the pardon boards who didn't recommend it. We come at it from a different perspective. We would retry anyone convicted of murder with their conviction overturned. We would retry them. I mean, that's what we do. That we represent victims. We don't represent defendants. So we come from a different perspective from pardon boards and governors. That's their arena. They determine what they're going to do. I am not a pardon board.
Linda LeGrand, do you think race enters in here?
Well, there's no question that race enters into this. Not only in the ruling from the Fifth Circuit, which that wasn't just about one black person being put on the grand jury. It was about race. It was about white commissioners using race-coded cards to thumb through them and choose whoever they wanted. And the black person that they put on Rito's grand jury was one of the commissioner's yard men. He was a yard boy that worked for one of the commissioners. But this case has been about race from the beginning, and the problem is that out in Calcasieu Parish, from all the research that we did, we mounted a major study 10 years ago, and we found that every black person ever convicted of murder in Calcasieu Parish, the murder of a white person, was given the death penalty when it was available. The flip side of that coin is that no black person convicted of murdering a white person in Calcasieu Parish has ever gotten clemency. Mr. Bryant says that his office has always objected to clemency for murderers in that parish. That's just not the case. We have records showing that murderers from that parish have been released. They've been released without objection from the district attorney, or with a sort of pro forma objection of a letter being sent to the pardon board. They don't mount this kind of objection against other prisoners. And as for Mr. Bryant's statement that he's in the business of defending victims, I would hope that he's in the business of seeking justice. And I don't think that any reasonable person would be able to see a retrial after 40 years. Mr. Rito has been in prison longer than any criminal offender in the history of Calcasieu Parish.
On that
note,
not
a threat to society. There's no legitimate.
We have to wrap up, Linda LeBranche. The Rito Project contact number.
At RitoProject@juno.com.
And we'll put information on the rundown at democracynow.org. That does it for the show. Chris Abrams, thanks for producing. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.